I will now start officially. Welcome to the 249th edition of Europe Calling. This is the first webinar in 2026, and it is already a blockbuster with over 5,000 registrations. It's really fabulous. My name is Maximilian Fries. I'm the Managing Director of Europe Calling, and I will be moderating this evening's meeting. I would like to welcome our special guests, Karen Hau, Alexander Geser and Michael Förtsch, and I'll introduce them in more detail in a minute. I would like to encourage you to use the interpretation that we offer.
Welcome to this webinar episode of Europe Calling 249. We're going to speak a mix of German and English today. And if you need the interpretation function, you can find it on a little globe in the control panel and just hit English and you will hear our two wonderful interpreters.
As always, you can put your questions to Europe Calling. We will be offering you Slido for this purpose. My colleague will be opening the channel in a second, and then you can also like the questions of others, rate them, and they will move upwards. And I think that'll be quite a huge challenge to reach the top of the list. Please also put your name to the question. I don't really want to keep saying anonymous user asks. As always, Europe Calling will be recorded and will be posted online on YouTube as a podcast afterwards. That's all for the announcement, and I would now like to introduce Karen Hau. She's an American journalist and currently writes for The Atlantic. Amongst others, she was a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Hong Kong and a senior editor for Artificial Intelligence at the MIT Technology Review. She's here today because she published a book, Empire of AI, in 2025 and has been promoting it. It immediately became a new New York Times bestseller. And now I would like to pass the floor to her so that she can introduce herself.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Max, and thank you to everyone for being here. I'm incredibly honored to be presenting this today. I am going to share my slides. Let's see if that works. Can everyone see that okay? Great. Did I successfully share the audio, Max?
Well, we'll
you
see.
See that coming. We'll see.
No, I can't. I can't see it. But we'll at least
you can't see
it.
Okay. Let me try that one more time. I totally forgot to hit the. Oh, and now I can't figure out how to exit out. Okay, we'll just see. Thank you so much for being here. I have been covering AI for over the last 7 years, as mentioned by Max in the intro, for publications including MIT Technology Review, The Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. And I wanted to spend today giving you a preview of my book, Empire of AI, which tells the inside story of OpenAI and uses that as a lens to revisit the history of AI, the wide-reaching present-day impacts of this technology, and to argue for a different path for AI development in the future. I'm going to skip the corporate drama today. I encourage you to buy a copy of the book to read that and go straight into the most important question that courses through the book, which is how do we actually govern AI to maximize its benefits and minimize its harms? And in the context of this talk, what role should Europe play in that governance? So part of the challenge of talking about AI today is the lack of specificity in the term artificial intelligence. It's like the word transportation. You could be referring to a bicycle or a rocket, an electric train, a gas-guzzling truck, and these are all different forms of transportation, but they clearly serve different purposes and they have different cost-benefit trade-offs. I think of AI in the very same way. It refers to such a wide variety of different technologies. So when we're talking about maximizing its benefits, the answer is not simply that we need more of the technology, but in fact, which AI technologies do we need more of? Which ones should we have less of? And how do we continue improving existing as well as designing new forms of AI in which the benefits outweigh the harms? I'd argue that the kinds of AI systems that dominate our headlines and our imagination today, large-scale, general-purpose, quote-unquote, systems like ChatGPT represent the worst trade-offs in the portfolio of existing AI technologies. They exact an extraordinary cost on large swaths of society, and they accrue benefit to a tiny group at the top. And that's why I make the argument that the companies that are leading the development of these types of systems are empires of AI. They act just like empires of old. First, they lay claim to resources that are not their own, the data of individuals, the intellectual property of artists, writers, and creators. Second, they exploit an extraordinary amount of labor, both the workers who make a critical contribution to the wealth creation of these companies, as well as workers whose jobs get automated away by the technology itself. Third, they monopolize knowledge production. They bankroll most of the AI researchers in the world, and they end up censoring and controlling the research that those researchers get to publish to support the empire's imperial expansion. And you can think of this akin to if most of the climate scientists in the world were bankrolled by fossil fuel companies, we would clearly not get an accurate picture of the climate crisis. And fourth and finally, these companies justify their actions with a moral and existential imperative. They are the good empire on a civilizing mission to bring progress and modernity to all of humanity. They are essentially promising that they will bring us to something akin to an AI heaven. And if they lose to the evil empires that they are competing with, then instead humanity will end up in an AI hell. So my critique of today's dominant systems really boils down to this: their scale. What do I mean by scale? The size of the data sets for training a single AI system have dramatically grown, as has the amount of computational resources being used to perform that training. Both of these charts are actually in logarithmic scale. So we're not only just seeing an exponential increase in both data and compute, but we're seeing a far faster acceleration of that increase in just the last few years. Here's a different way of looking at it through OpenAI's technologies. So, in the 4 years between 2019 and 2023, OpenAI scaled its GPT models by more than 10,000 times. That's 10,000 times more data, 10,000 times more compute. And in reporting my book, I found that in order to achieve that scale, OpenAI dramatically dropped its regard for intellectual property as well as its standards for data quality. So, whereas OpenAI used curated articles and websites to train GPT-2, it started pirating books and it indiscriminately scraped the internet and transcribed YouTube videos against YouTube's terms of service in order to train GPT-4. And this is the same story for all of the main AI model developers. So, if we were to summarize the harms of aggressively scaling training data, we have infringements on data privacy, the erosion of intellectual property, the perpetuation of an engagement-centric model of social media. We are increasingly getting evidence that companies are purposely designing their models to be more addictive in order to harvest more data from users. They also result in more polluted data sets, which then leads to the downstream harm of labor exploitation. Because once your data is polluted, you now have to deal with the problem of content moderation. And so in my book, I traveled to Kenya to meet with the workers that OpenAI contracted to perform this content moderation. And specifically, the workers were asked to build a content moderation filter that OpenAI could wrap around its models to block problematic generations from ever reaching their users. And what that meant was the workers had to wade through some of the worst content on the internet, as well as AI-generated content where OpenAI was prompting its models to imagine the worst content on the internet. And they put this into a detailed taxonomy. Is this hate speech, harassment, violent content, sexual content? Does the sexual content involve abuse? Does that abuse involve children? For OpenAI, this work was crucial to the success of ChatGPT, and it made the company a household name overnight. But I want you to hear in the workers' own words what it was like to perform this work for them. This is Alex Cairo. He was 28 years old when I interviewed him, and he was on the violent content team for OpenAI, which meant that he was reading and labeling scenarios like murders, stabbings, and self-harm.
So when you would go home at night, like what would you think about after 8 hours of reading all of that stuff?
Oh, my mental state was very bad. I had nightmares. I feared people. Maybe I see too many people coming, I see violence. If I see someone holding a fork or a razor blade, I see people cutting himself or something like that. At night, I will dream, I will have nightmares. Even I'll tell my brother, okay, just come here, sit with me like for 5 hours before I go to sleep, because I need someone to talk to before I go to sleep, because if I go to sleep, I'll start screaming or something like that. So many things are going a lot in my mind, yeah.
The aggressive scaling of compute is leading to a whole other set of unprecedented challenges. Whereas models used to be trained on single digits of computer chips or maybe a dozen computer chips, now they're trained on supercomputers running tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of computer chips. And these supercomputers are not like data centers that power our modern digitally mediated lives. This is Meta's first data center in 2011, and this is the newest AI data center that Meta is building currently, which is nearly 400 times larger and on track to be one-fifth the size of Manhattan. So if we once again summarize what happens when you aggressively scale compute, that leads to things like accelerated mineral extraction, increased energy and fresh water consumption, utility price hikes for consumers, strain on grid infrastructure. A US regulator warned last year that data centers are threatening the reliability of the grid in the US, and it leads to greater carbon emissions. In fact, a report from the UN last June found that four of the leading AI companies increased their emissions by 150% since 2020, which is exactly the year that they all promised they would reduce their emissions to zero. And what scale are we actually talking about? I mean, per a McKinsey report, in the conservative scenario, data centers could need as much energy as one and a half Germanys by the end of the decade. And in an accelerated scenario, it could need nearly four Germanys. Aside from energy, data centers need fresh water to cool. And in an investigation last year, Bloomberg found that two-thirds of the newly built data centers are going into water-stressed areas globally, which is very much also true for Europe. One of the reasons for this is that when companies choose a location for their data centers, they're looking for a combination of different factors: cheap electricity, abundant land, limited natural disasters. And ironically, deserts often check off these boxes. But I also believe that there's another reason at play, which is that there are simply not enough places in the world anymore untouched by the ravages of climate change. We are seeing a catastrophic collision between the acceleration of AI and the climate crisis. And in fact, here's a recent example of exactly this playing out in Spain. This is an Amazon data center campus in Aragon, in the north of the country. And in December of 2024, Amazon asked the Aragon government for permission to increase its water consumption at its three existing data centers by 48%. And Amazon wrote in its own application that climate change will lead to an increase in global temperatures and the frequency of extreme weather events, including heat waves, which is why they needed 48% more water. And this Guardian piece also quotes an expert who says that with 75% of the country already at risk of desertification, the combination of the climate crisis and data center expansion is bringing Spain to the verge of ecological collapse. And yet, last year, Amazon proposed three new data centers in this region, which are predicted to use more electricity than the entire region itself. Here's the extraordinary part. This scale is unnecessary. You do not need this degree of data and compute to reap the benefits of AI development. In fact, there was recently this really excellent paper that just came out last month from Sarah Hooker, a very prominent AI researcher, synthesizing all of the research that shows this. And we have seen this reality in action with models like DeepSeek, which demonstrated that it is possible to develop the same capabilities with significantly less computation. And that doesn't account for the full range of other AI systems that already exist and have nothing to do with large-scale systems and are hugely beneficial. Nor does it account for the new techniques that could be developed with more research that could bring even greater benefit at less cost. So I would actually argue that the scaling approach to AI development is not bringing us innovation, but rather costing us innovation. In the first quarter of last year, nearly half of all venture money went into two companies, OpenAI and Anthropic. So the scaling approach is eating up a huge share of the capital, not just for investing in other types of AI approaches, but actually for other types of technologies in general. AI, this massive investment in AI development is also destabilizing the economy. This is a brilliant analysis from Kyla Scanlon, who is an economics writer, and I would highly recommend everyone reading this specific post. In it, she posts about how weak the US economy really is. While the stock market is flying, it's entirely based on the circular investment activities of the AI empires. When you remove the AI plays from the US stock market, it turns out that the European stock markets have been outperforming the US in this decade. But Scanlon argues that the facade of a strong stock market gives the Trump administration enormous power. It provides cover for his political actions, from threatening allies to deploying ICE. So he continues to put the full force of Washington behind Silicon Valley. So this is now the moment that we're in. We're seeing a historic alliance between two empires, the empires of AI and the American empire. And it's akin to a modern-day reprising of the British East India Company abetted in its reckless expansion by the British Crown. And if we continue down this path, the consequence will not just be labor exploitation, environmental fallout, public health crisis. If we return to the age of empire, democracy will not survive. So the question is, how can Europe do things differently? Fundamentally, we need to separate AI from empire. We want the benefits of AI. We absolutely cannot have it at the cost to our democracy. So we need to break up the empire as we simultaneously cultivate new, sustainable, rights-preserving, democratic paths of AI development. And this will require a multi-pronged long-term approach. First, we need to break away from the empire. So Europe should be weaning its reliance off of US products. Every time you use the tools of the empires of AI, you send them more data, you cede them more power. So in the short term, it's better to shift to open source models because at the very least, you're no longer giving those companies your data. And in the long term, Europe should be developing alternatives, not just to AI models, but to infrastructure, such as proposed by the Eurostack. Second, we need to reject the empire's ideology. In other words, stop scaling. You could say that large-scale generative AI models are like the rockets of transportation. Generally speaking, there's a very small number of transportation needs where we actually want to deploy rockets. And we wouldn't actually want everyone to have a rocket. If people were using rockets to commute from Munich to Paris, that would make no sense. It's simply not fit for purpose. And this is how we should be thinking about AI. Most of the things we want out of AI will not be solved by bigger and bigger models, just as most of the reasons we need transportation will not be solved by bigger and bigger rockets. And I often hear Europeans say, we are falling behind the US. But the question is, how are you defining the race in which you are behind? I think it would be a huge mistake to define this race as building bigger and bigger rockets. That, to me, is a race to the bottom. And so it wouldn't end up well for anyone. So the bottom line, less rockets, and more bicycles. And what's a bicycle of AI? Well, here's an example, DeepMind's AlphaFold. This is a system for predicting how a protein will fold based on its amino acid sequence. This is a crucial step for accelerating drug discovery and for understanding diseases. And in 2024, AlphaFold won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. This is a bicycle of AI because it is a small, task-specific AI model tackling a well-scoped problem that lends itself to the computational strengths of AI. It is not trained on the internet. It's trained on highly curated data sets. It does not need content moderation. There's no need for vast supercomputers, and it's still unlocking enormous public benefit. Here's another example, AI systems that mitigate instead of accelerate the climate crisis. There's a nonprofit called Climate Change AI, composed of some of the top AI researchers around the world, that catalogs all of the challenges that different types of AI tools could help overcome. Transitioning away from fossil fuels, improving the energy efficiency of buildings, tracking emissions, optimizing supply chains, forecasting extreme weather events. And once again, each of these problems are well-scoped, they're computational in nature, and each of the tools listed here are small, computationally efficient, task-specific AI tools that have nothing to do with large-scale generative models. Third, we want to break up the empire's monopoly of knowledge. In other words, we need to increase transparency across the whole AI supply chain. What data is being used to train these models? Where are these data centers going? How much energy and water are they using? Which AI applications are using which AI models in the back end? Unless we have visibility into each step of AI development and deployment, we cannot fully understand the capabilities, pitfalls, or impacts of these AI systems. And this is an area where Europe can play a role, not just for itself, but for the world. The best lever for compelling companies to be transparent is legislation and regulation. And this goes to another thing that I often hear Europeans say, which is we've regulated too much. We need to deregulate. And I would reframe this. It's not about regulating less, but about regulating better. Where there may be some regulations, certainly, to roll back, the EU AI Act's transparency obligations, for example, for general purpose AI models, is crucial to keep and should be strengthened, in fact. And there are needs for more transparency requirements across the rest of the supply chain. Fourth and finally, we need to create new centers of knowledge production outside of the empire by investing in independent research and producing open science. The empires of AI cannot be our only source of information, nor can they be our only source of imagination about the future. And this is another area where Europe can strengthen its own sovereignty while making a huge contribution to the world. Europe should double down on investing in independent AI research. And I know the EU is already making some strides in this regard. This will be an essential pillar to continue cultivating both research to improve existing AI systems, and even more importantly, to perform fundamental basic science research to understand what should go in this box. These pillars are also going to reinforce one another. The more transparency there is, the more clear it will be what the existing challenges are, which will help define the research agenda. And the more independent research there is, the more of a foundation there is to develop alternative AI tools and other parts of the AI stack to stop depending on US technologies. Is this going to be easy? Absolutely not. This is going to be a long-term project. And that is why we urgently need to start it now. So I wanted to end with a story I reference in the epilogue of my book, which I wrote in 2022 for MIT Technology Review. And this is a story that's always stuck in my mind because it completely expanded my vision for what an alternative vision for artificial intelligence can be. So the selfie at the bottom right here is of Peter Lucas Jones and Kioni Mahalona. They are life partners that run Tehiku Media, a nonprofit radio station in New Zealand that broadcasts in Te Reo Māori, the language of the Māori indigenous people. In recent years, there's been a big push among the Māori people to revitalize their own language because, like many indigenous peoples, they almost lost it due to colonization policies. Keone and Peter Lucas wanted to support this revitalization movement by opening up Tohiku's archive as a language learning resource for the community, where people could use an app to listen to the broadcasts in Tareo and engage in an interactive transcript where they could click on words that they don't know and they could see a translation. But to create the transcripts, they ran into a problem, which is they didn't have enough speakers proficient in Tareo. So they realized they could turn to AI and build a speech recognition tool. This is where the process diverged, their process diverged completely from the way Silicon Valley develops AI. First, they asked the community, "Do you want this AI tool?" And only when the community said yes, then they engaged in a public education process to explain what it would take to build this tool. And they started a community drive asking people to donate their data for training the model with their full consent. And because they were training a small task-specific AI tool, and because they had so much buy-in from the community, they were actually able to collect enough data within just a few days. And once they trained their model, they continued to engage with the community, checking in on how to improve the model, what kinds of resources they could use the model to build. And they created a process to ensure that if anyone else ever wanted access to their training data, they would need the consent of the community and they would need to sign a legally binding document to ensure that the data was not used in ways that harmed the community. This is the vision of AI we should be building towards, a vision that is community-driven, consentful, respectful of local context and history, a vision that uplifts and strengthens marginalized communities, a vision that is inclusive and democratic. We do not need empires, nor do we need the one-size-fits-all models that they're trying to peddle us. We should have bicycles of AI built like Tohiku, diffused broadly across communities and the economy. I hope if there's one more thing that you take away from this talk, it's this. Each and every one of you, regardless of where you sit, has an active role to play in shaping technology development, in resisting the empires, in fortifying our collective future. Because empires are made to feel inevitable, but history has shown us that when people rise, empires always fall. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, there are so many thoughts in my mind right now, but I want to, before I give to Michael, actually come back on one question, which I found when I read the book was really key in understanding, the whole idea of it. So you started off with why, there's compute and there is data, or so chips and data that need to be in there to get those models bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So why do those models need to get bigger? So what's the reason? What's the aim of it? Where does it need to be? So why become always bigger, and why do they always need more data? And like the, as you saw, said, the darkest corners of the internet are now in within those models.
It's a really great question. And from a technical, if I were to answer it technically, you do not actually need there to be more data and for these models to get bigger and bigger, which is the paper that I referenced from Sarah Hooker, where she lists all of the different research that has demonstrated this. There are many different ways to actually advance the capabilities of AI without this kind of scale. But the companies chose the path of scale because it is essentially the intellectually easiest way to continue advancing at a steady and predictable clip. Because they discovered that by simply using more data and simply using more compute, you can sort of guarantee, in a way, gains in the development of the models. That is actually now being challenged because as the models have grown to a extraordinary, unfathomable scale, we are starting to see that scale have marginal improvements. It is no longer leading to that same kind of linear improvement. But it really is like this, the scaling ideology is really driven not by the science, but actually by politics and economics and the business of these companies.
And they have an aim, as you describe it, right? Because at the end of the day, they want to arrive at general artificial intelligence, right? So they want to arrive at this AI heaven with that as fast as possible. I mean, that is in terms of trajectory.
Exactly. Yes. So they're all in this sort of quasi, what I describe as a quasi-religious race to try and reach artificial general intelligence, which is this idea of an AI system that matches or even exceeds human intelligence, but is one that once again is not really rooted in science. It's a theoretical notion. No one really knows if it's possible, but that is what motivates these companies, this idea that they're on the path to building an AI god, and that they each individual company tells a story to itself about why they need to be the one that builds the AI god first.
Yeah, thank you very much. Exactly. So this was the feeling from reading it. This is really, so if you really fully understand it, I think you need to read the book. But I think this is kind of this idea of this trajectory where this is going. This really helped me a lot to understand like all the effects that you were describing. So but apart from that, you see, I could have just have a chat with you for the next hour, I guess. But I need to let the other people talk as well. So deswegen gehe ich jetzt ins Deutsche und darf Dr. Michael Förtsch vorstellen. Michael
And now I would
Förtsch
like to
ist Gründer
turn
und
to
Direktor der
German,
Firma
and I would like to
Deep
introduce
Tech
Dr.
Tools.
Michael
Michael hat
Förtsch.
sich
Michael Förtsch is the founder
Doktor
and the
gemacht,
CEO
dann
of a deep
bei
tech
Intersect und dann bei
startup,
einem großen
Quant.
Neuroanalytiker
He
Unternehmen
completed his
gearbeitet,
doctorate
Startup
at the
gegründet,
Max
Quantum
Planck
Computing
Institute on
entwickelt
Physics of
und
Light
Quantenphysik
and worked in a large
aufgebaut.
mechanical
Danach war
engineering
er
company
bei
in
Quantum Amazon
Baden-Württemberg
in Hamburg,
until he
Microsoft in
founded
Birmingham
Quant
und
in
jetzt wurde er
Stuttgart.
von
And
Karen
I'm very
Gillan
curious
bei
to
Microsoft
hear your
vorgeschlagen,
thoughts,
Deutsche
because
Unternehmen
Karen already
investigen
showed us in her
Technologien weiter
analysis
geworden
that
und
we
er hat
really
dann
do need a
Geschäftsführung
new
von Meteor
approach,
gewechselt zu
and we
Silicon
also
Valley
need to
Silicon
take
Valley
along
war jetzt
the
Silicon
political
Valley
side
Technology
of
Distribution Center
the
und
things
Konsolidierung
of all matters digital,
Technologiestandort
but I'd like to hear
Hamburg.
from Michael
Let's
first.
go.
Yes, thank you very much.
Ist
It is
ist vielleicht
really
auch spannend,
hugely
dass diese
impressive.
Simulation
It's
Zugriff
also
auf
very impressive to
Quantenphysik
see the number of
Computationen
participants, and I would
ist
like
entstanden
to
auf
actually
Ebene.
call up
Und
the
jetzt noch die
PowerPoint.
meistgehörte Frage:
Can you see my
Ist Max
slides?
schwarz?
And I
Jetzt
don't
höre ich
hear
dich nicht
Max
mehr.
any
Nein, Max, ich höre
longer.
dich nicht mehr. Da musst du jetzt noch einmal klicken, wo ich
Then
hingehe, das
perhaps
PowerPoint nicht mehr teilen.
I should not share the
Das
PowerPoint
PowerPoint
any
nicht mehr
longer. Now
teilen.
we're
Und ja,
fine.
ich
Now
höre
we're
dich.
good.
Jetzt sind wir gut. Jetzt
Okay,
kannst du mich
alles
hören.
klar.
Perfekt. Also,
The
dann
bad thing really
die
is
Stimme
that
ist
when
eigentlich
you're
nur
the
so als zweiter
second
Stimme im Hintergrund
speaker,
und du hörst es eigentlich echt gut, muss ich sagen, an der
it's
Stelle. Aber
really
es ist
not
wirklich
possible for
sehr
me
ein sehr
to
popular Reset.
talk to you in a controversial
Beziehungsweise die
sense.
Institution Karen und dann
I
auch den
would
Ausblick auf die
like
britische
to
Union,
perhaps
den ich vielleicht
understand
noch
my
ganz
role
kurz
as
im
building the
Unterricht
bridge
der
between
Sozio
Karen
und
and the
der Mitgründerin
European
überhaupt in der Zeit,
Union and
bevor
the
dieses Technologhaus
European
zusammenhing,
role.
kollabiert,
But
nämlich
let
während
me remind
Großbritannien
you
überhaupt
that the
Europa versus USA.
per capita
Und dazu habe ich dann mal so über die Jahrzehnte hinweg die einzelnen
economic
Wirtschaften und Technologien
result
Großbritannien und
of
USA in den
Europe and the
1970er und
US
1980er
is
Zeit und
interesting
beide
to look at
Nationen
because
im Vergleich
we are looking at
Bruttoinlandsprodukt
a gross
Staatsbeitrag
a national
das Ganze dann
product
aber ungefähr
which
2 bis
used to
5
be
Prozent
almost equal
und
in the
völlig
past. And
unwichtig
then
dafür geworden,
suddenly
dass man hier von Geldsätzen bis
it
Geld
took
und
a
damit
diverge.
Wohlstand, der Wohlstand und die Bevölkerung
And
durchsetzt.
I think that is very
Das ist mein
important
jetziger
also to bear
Aspekt
in
des
mind
Skandals.
that there's an economic interest behind all of this. And I would like to raise the
Diese
question
Frage
whether
möchte ich
we
gerne
can
nutzen, des
afford not
Wohlstands
to
der
invest
kleinen
in
Industrien, die es hier gibt.
AI and
Ansonsten
in
würden wir
technology.
hier viel zu
I
Hause
do
bleiben.
feel
Das
that we
Zweite, was ich im Vorfeld
urgently need
machen
to
werde,
invest
ist
in
ein
that
Gespräch
technological field. And I would
durchaus
also
unterschiedliche
like to
Botschaften
provoke
in
a
der
little
Bevölkerung zu
bit
senden, sein,
because
USA
the
bleiben
US
wird,
is probably
generell
caught in an
innovativ
innovator's dilemma.
ähnlich Ziel
We have
Vorbildfunktion
already
bleiben, hier
seen
toll
in
gewesen,
the analysis
hier toll zu
and the
bleiben müssen,
charts
sie
that were
befreundet, sie sprechen sehr gut
presented
miteinander,
that
sagen wir mal
The data center are growing hugely and very fast, but the progress that is felt by the consumers is not really that magnificent any longer. So the benefits are hardly felt by the consumers, and I think that we have a bit of a window of an opportunity here, and I would normally not shout out things very loudly, but I do think that perhaps time is up for actually turning proactively to artificial intelligence. However, we must make sure that we don't destroy our planet, and looking at it from Europe, we could almost benefit from the dilemma of the US in terms of AI. I'm sure that some of you in the audience have already participated in this ChatGPT challenge to generate these action figures. I thought it was quite a fun game. But the question that you need to ask yourself is, what's the price of all of this? And how long does it take if a graphic card is to create such a figure? How long does it take? Normally, it takes 10 seconds on average. And that is dependent on technology. It doesn't have anything to do with getting it faster and roll it out more broadly. It's simply bound by the chip capacity that is available. So what we see over the years, and I think this is a very truthful description of the graphic card industry, it's pretty irrelevant from who you buy your chips, because they all have the same computing capacities. They're all built on the same system and they have the same dimension. And that's why the computational density, whether you buy from one or the other provider, the capacity will remain the same. And then perhaps you should raise the question how computing has changed from the 70s. It hasn't really changed. It's all become much smaller in size. And because we can't make it much smaller any longer, we now roll it out and use more space. But the way we compute hasn't really changed. We know how much storage we need to actually compute a certain complex figures, for example. And then if you ask yourself the question, how much energy do I need to create such a figure? It's always very abstract, of course. I normally compare that to charging a normal smartphone. Is it 20% of the charge capacity, 50 or 100? It's 100 being charged on 20 watts. But 30 billion pictures are being generated for nothing. And it really costs us the energy consumption of an entire city. And the data centers really don't make any further progress because they don't save anything in energy consumption. So it's the fundamental truth that it all becomes much more difficult because of the high energy consumption. And it's a bit of a paradox. Would you like to take a quantum step in technology development? Yes or no? And you really need to have good arguments for that. And from the European perspective, perhaps we could acknowledge that we have almost nothing to say. They are from the US normally, they are made in Taiwan, and if European companies are lucky, they can participate in a small way in the production cycle. But normally, we receive the ready-to-use product in Europe. And it's really difficult for us to see ourselves becoming active in any meaningful way in the old semiconductor industry. We would not then become very active in the state-of-the-art technological advances. We will not really be defining the future of artificial intelligence. Now, what we did here in Europe is something that is already known in the international context. We simply replaced power, ordinary power, by light. And on the fundamental basis, this change offers a potential of sovereignty. We have built a pilot chip and a processor in Stuttgart. We have used a refurbished old production line for our photonic AI processor. And we developed it step by step locally in Stuttgart. It's mathematically rather complex. It's not a replacement of a graphic card. It is an additional supplementary technology. It simply computes in a different way, but we need less energy to produce the same result. And we are in the world the first company that really seamlessly adds onto the old computing system on a working on a photonic basis in the processing of data. On the level of algorithms, we also allow using algorithms that only use a small part of the architecture, which is rather heavy in the old computing system. So we are now working at a solution which will be smarter and not ever more complex and harder to implement. So the neuronal net was used to simply reproduce Van Gogh's paintings. And we compared the traditional technology with the new ones. For the description of the model, we need 50 times less data points than the traditional system. That means that we need less surface on the chip and less more and less energy and less computing complexity. And another 150 iterations can be added. If the digital linear industry is still looking for the solution, we are done already. They need much more time to come to this result. And that, I think, is something that is well known in the American industry already, they are still sticking to the old architecture because millions of jobs have been created there and must not be lost. But we have an opportunity in Europe to perhaps do things differently. On the right-hand side here, you can see the blockbuster of the data centers being used at Amazon operations or Meta with and they use energy of medium-sized city to keep going. They also need huge cooling devices. That is why they need such huge surfaces in order to provide for the water cooling. Now, our photonic chips, however, they don't really heat up. On the same server, we can really reduce the space and we can fit in more cards because every processor of ours only needs as much as an ordinary household oven, 1 kilowatt. Computing accelerators have a much higher performance, and they only use a small part of the energy that the traditional system uses. So the system computes 100 times more data and uses 90% less energy. What should be the next step? Well, we should really implement it. We should use it. We should roll it out. And I think we do have a singular opportunity to offer a supplementary, an add-on technology in computing. We have no risks to avert. We do have only an opportunity. Of course, it does take courage because the Americans have always used one particular technology, and this newly developed technology would really deviate from that totally. And Karen also started talking about opting for your own way. You should build your future. You shouldn't copy what the US does. We need our own future design. And we should also be willing to lead the way. Because why shouldn't we be using European development? I think that should be the precondition to develop our own way into the artificial intelligence era. And we also need to speed up because we're not the ones who started the development, and the developments were started about 15 years ago when the Americans started up with considering developing artificial intelligence, and nobody even used the term over here in Europe. So that is why we really need to catch up really fast because the first mover will take 80% of the market. You can see that from the giants, how they really took much more than 70% of their individual markets, always the first movers. And those are huge markets if those chips are accepted in the market. And for the political class, of course, the role would be to support this development, to allow for these risks to be taken, to set up financing programs for that. If a German company, for example, invests into artificial intelligence, they should first look around and see whether they could use European developments and innovations, because I need to, in the long run, control the whole stack. I should really be the owner of all the components, because otherwise, if I have another foreign element in there, it would also dictate that. And that brings me to the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Vielen, vielen Dank dir. Auch wieder ein großartiger Vortrag. Auch wir haben ganz, ganz viele Fragen. Ich lasse aber die Fragen jetzt mal fürs Ende und gehe jetzt mal direkt zu Alexander.
I leave the questions now for the end and we'll come to Alexandra. And for all who don't know you, I would like to present Alexandra Gils, a member of the European Parliament for the Greens Alliance 90 in the European Parliament, responsible for digital policies, and according to Politico, she is one of the 10 Europe's emerging power players, has advocated for technological sovereignty, and was this crucial in the negotiations for the Digital Services Act, which is criticized at the moment, and is one of the initiators of Eurostax, which has the objective to make the EU technologically independent. She is in our board, does a lot of jobs. Alexandra, please. Thank you very much, Max. Good evening. I'm one of the board members of Europe Calling, and I'm tonight very proud because what you do here tonight is really world class. So thank you very much, you two who have been speaking so far. It's very rare that we have so highly qualified specialists here who can talk in such an understandable way about artificial intelligence. So it's great, and I'm thankful that I can be with you tonight too. I'd like to go back a little, and I'd like to ask, what is artificial intelligence? Not in a technical sense, but in today's political practice. And in my experience, it's an infrastructure of power. The way I experience artificial intelligence, it is not technology, but power. Power over the knowledge, control over which knowledge reaches the people. And if you think how many people study at universities or in schools or in politics or in the economy, how many people use ChatGPT, which means that ChatGPT can decide which are the suggestions made to people, how they are weighted, you can see that it's an infrastructure of Kevin Howe has already explained how big the AI bubble is. Actually, if you look and how far these companies invest in one another in order to get good prices at the stock markets, and you see what it means for the US economy, but also in Europe, because we are told in Europe that we have to reach the same values. You see that the economical power of these companies, also the European powers, can be extreme at the global level, startups, but also classical industry companies, Amazon, for example, retail basically has a lot of power, and there is a huge lobby potential that comes with this extreme wealth that is produced, 100 million per year, lobbying budgets here in Brussels and in other capitals. It's similar. This all has an enormous influence on politicians, on people who have really power in governments, and who are continuously confronted with these influences, with this ideology, and then end up believing in this ideology that all problems can be used with AI. And then there are no European companies who can do the same thing. And we've just heard in the speeches, we've heard that this is not true, that we do have European companies. All this is power, and the form of power with which I'm confronted here in Brussels is the political power, because we have a US administration at the moment, which is really standing up for the interests of these companies in plural, because it's not only OpenAI. They really support worldwide and also towards Europe the interests of these big companies. We have heard about the sanctions against state aid to persons of a Berlin organization because they represent victims of hatred in the internet. They cannot now not travel to the US any longer. Then also proceedings against the former EU commissioner Breton, with whom I negotiated a lot during those digital politics negotiations. And in Europe, the commission is called upon or forced to revise digital acts we have, digital services acts, regulations of digital networks, also powered by a lot of AI. And the threat is that if we don't do it, the US is not going to supply weapons to Ukraine, which they are not doing at the moment anyway, but they will be then become even more of an ally of Putin. So all this is political power. And then there is also the political connection. Karen mentioned it, the CEOs of all these companies. Were present when Trump's presidency was inaugurated. These are also examples of political power. And this means if AI is an example for power, and power has to do with sovereignty, also sovereignty of democracies, then the question is, how can we reclaim this sovereignty? And I think only if we build the technology in Europe and become independent of American, but also of Chinese companies. I don't know, Karen, if you want to say something as to Chinese companies. Because many say that China is more advanced than the US at the moment. We don't see it because we do not we're not able to observe everything. But if the AI bubble in the US bursts, then it will be China's turn to take over the lead. So we have to get organized in Europe. It's really high time, I think. And together with others, about a year ago, I set up the Eurostack, a big initiative so that Europe can become technologically sovereign, especially digital technologies in Europe, that we build them ourselves. And where we cannot do it, we have to cooperate with the rest of the world, but in a way that doesn't make us dependent on them. We don't want to build up walls around Europe. No, we want the digital exchange with the world, but we cannot become dependent on others. We have to decide ourselves on our own rules for the digital world. And at least in large areas, we should build up the physical capacities of building these systems. Something which has been mentioned, public money for the industry, especially in the digital area, a lot of money that the taxpayer pays goes into investments for American companies, because this is something we want to change in Europe, because the way the provisions are, if you want to participate in such procurement actions, is in a way that European companies have no chance. So this will be our battle. Your European Commission is backing us. The President von der Leyen announced this. Countries like France are very active, but the federal government is very reluctant, to put it mildly. So this has not become as natural as it should be. And there are also quite a lot of other legislative proposals which are in the pipeline, but you can imagine that the lobbies will be strong, against which we have to fend. And sometimes here in Brussels, it is said that maybe we don't have a chance anymore, that the train has already left, that it's too late for us. And I think we've just heard that, yes, we have a chance. There are also different technology stages where you can maybe jump upon the train. And this is what we have to keep in mind. That's what we have to have. To be attentive and have thereby decide what happens in Europe. Well, what is our vision for artificial intelligence, you may ask, if you look around in Brussels. Maybe I go back another step. We have been told that this very ideological version with artificial intelligence, which we heard with AGI now, is able to solve all our problems, climate change, cancer, all the diseases of humankind. But what we realize daily in politics and what the people also see is that we see pictures on X of naked women and children. That's what AI is used for. Many of those images which are generated are basically sexual violence against women and child abuse. So there is a lot of disinformation out there, which undermines our democracies. And that means that elections can be massively manipulated. It already happens. And this is also one of the dangers which Karen has also made clear in her speech. But it's important that we do not back away from this, that we don't get frightened and say, well, technology is bad, artificial intelligence is very dangerous, which is partly true. There are dangers and harm is already happening, but it's really important that we don't give up this area. It's very clear. We do not want to be part of the AI empire, so well described by Karen here in Europe. We would be in at the periphery of the empire, which is never a nice place to be. And this means that now we have to see that autocracies invest a lot in technologies. China in a very structured way for decades already, and then countries like the US, which are basically democracies, but over there the concentration of wealth and power is such that the democracy suffers. And we, the real democracies, have to invest massively into these technologies too. How can we do it? I think we have to make clearer which are the desirable technologies, not for the companies. This is not what we should look at. No, we should think about how we as democracies can set incentives to get what we need in the field of the environment, the climate, medicine, effective manufacturing, for example, because we will have less water and natural resources at our disposal. So how can we set the incentives in a way that what is produced is also makes also sense for humankind and not only for a few men in the northern hemisphere? And we should also see to it that there is a broad basis of companies, not a few very big companies, that we also have small and medium-sized companies which can participate without having such an enormous concentration of the very few, which would then mean that they have enormous power. Wealth, prosperity, as Michael said, is important, but the distribution of wealth is also very important. And this is exactly what is not happening in the United States. A few keep the wealth, and this never reaches the middle income spheres of the society. Statistics make this clear. This is something we have to talk about too. And then we have to see to it that the companies obey the laws. which they often do not, these large companies, especially not in Europe. And then we have to see how we can use the technology to save the climate and protect our environment. And how can we see to it that the income generated in this way is distributed fairly? If you talk to people who are texters or graphic designers, you see that a lot of people are in a very dire situation. So this we have to change so that the whole of the society benefits from these technologies. But in order to be able to do this, we have to be brave, have to think bravely. We should not negate everything, reject everything, but we should also not just say, well, we have to catch up what China and the US have already done, because we're running behind those who are already a kilometer more advanced than you are is never a good idea. We have to see where we want to get to and have to invest accordingly. We have to see which are the technologies that exist, and then in a very focused way, but also on a broad basis, we have to create the conditions so that technology leaps can happen in Europe, and that we can, thanks to them, strengthen democracy and save the planet. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm switching to English so we can have our Q&A, our discussion now in English. So thank you all. As Alexandra said, this was really impressive, and we have so many questions, so we could probably spend the next hours trying to answer them. But I'm gonna start with one question that actually came up quite a lot, and that also Alexander alluded to, and I want to give that first to Karen. So the question of China. So is China, and I mean you've been correspondent in, or you were correspondent in Hong Kong, so you know the place. So how is that? What is China doing it differently, or is it China far ahead using different technology? So when you compare what you found in your book with the situation in China, can you maybe elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah. So China is doing it quite differently because of the specific fact that the US used export controls to block American chips from going to Chinese companies. And so Chinese companies originally, when they saw ChatGPT, China had a ChatGPT moment just like the rest of the world. Many entrepreneurs and large tech incumbents also rushed to try and go with the scaling method of building larger and larger models. And then they were cut off from that approach by the US. And so we've seen a couple of different things that China has done. One is that some Chinese companies, like the company that made DeepSeek, it's a company called HiFlyer, they just have circumvented the chip controls by simply figuring out ways to get these advancements with less technologies. We've also seen a number of, including DeepSeek, a number of different companies that have gone the open source route, putting their models out in the open for anyone to use. And there's multiple different theories for why this is. One of the theories is that this current generation of entrepreneurs in China grew up at a time when the internet in China was more open and there was a lot more connectivity with the rest of the world. There was a much more robust open source computer science community, and so they still grew up in those values and those ethos, and they're projecting that into their work today. Another theory is that the government is also allowing them to do this because when you are a laggard, it is easier to eat the lunch of the forerunner by putting open source models out in the world. So those are kind of the two different divergent approaches that China's going for, and we've seen massive investments from companies and from the government into more native chip infrastructure, more native data center infrastructure as well, because China is also extremely intent on developing technological sovereignty all across the stack. They feel a lot of vulnerability that they were painfully reminded by when the US exerted the chip export controls. And so they've been, on a long journey to try and shore up all the different ways, all the different choke points that the US could have over China. Obviously, there are many different things within China that's happening today that are extremely concerning, but there are, I think, some interesting lessons to be learned for Europe from the way that Chinese companies have really focused on investing in different approaches to AI development in ways that are more relevant to their personal context, that are able to do the same things with less resources.
Thank you. Maybe getting Michael in here as well. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, export controls and chips not being as available in the US, would that also be something for, or is that something that you find in your technology and the interest from China as being something different, or would basically your technology fall under a similar export control? So how do you see that in terms of your interest in China and the role there?
So what I think in terms of export control, we are not making a fundamental difference here because from the top level view, we are, by the way, Max, you're frozen. hope you're still here. We're not falling in different
There
categories. There you are again. But let me, so in general, I'm a bit more impressed by what China has accomplished. So maybe especially in our photonics-based compute technology, we see a lot of action going on in China, including but thinking it holistically from the material stack to the entire software ecosystem. And we actually see that the interest in partnerships, at least in our domain, is growing. So the waving hand or the shaking hand or the collaboration hands, the offering, they're there. There is actually no month where we are not engaging with a more Chinese-based company to evaluate whether we could go on joint action. Of course, there's always this feeling, okay, is this how did would it end in the end? But technologically speaking, the way how Chinese currently develop deep tech is truly impressive to me, I must admit. And I would sense that they, because if they think not just in one direction, they sense, especially in the context of AI, and this was also what Karen said, because of the scarcity of limited access to these graphic card chips, they were forced to think in different directions, developing alternative models. And this thinking became the new narrative. So they're exploring models way outside of typical standards. And also, because of they were cutting away from the extreme UE technology, they had to think about how to get performance out of computers without having access to the latest node technology. And this all condenses together that, in my opinion, they're way more creative and come up with unique solutions that, on the one side, push performance, maybe on the development on the software, but also on the hardware stack, in combination with still being top-notch at the end product. So it's really impressive what's happening in China.
Yeah, it's interesting because it basically shows that also the, you know, narrative from the Silicon Valley narrative in a way is not the only way of doing this, and as in a practical example. So that's, you know, it's very interesting. So I want to go in now with the top question. Here, the top voted question from Hans-Jörg. He asked, is there any way for citizens to influence harmful forms and influences systems of AI to curb the excesses of it? And I found that very interesting because there are also other questions, for example, about a French AI company, Mistral, that are doing things. And also, when I remember reading Karen's book, there was also the discussion, for example, that, you know, part of OpenAI researchers were very concerned about safety and the way business would do, and they were actually moving out of the company for quite forcefully, and then founding Anthropic, what is now Anthropic. And you mentioned at the beginning that Anthropic is getting like the half of the funding, or like the, you know, second part of the funding now. So how do you see that as a, you know, when you are a citizen and now, and you think about, you know, now I'm using ChatGPT to my stuff, but after that talk, I really don't want to use that anymore. So, you know, it's, if you look at the alternative, is there a best case, is there a positive example of things that are commercially available where somebody could just say, no, from tomorrow on, I use this? I know we are bordering like advertising things here, but I think that's an important everyday question.
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of different things that individuals can do to resist the empire, so to speak. The way that I think about it is that there is the whole supply chain of AI development involves all of these different stages that can be points of pressure that individuals can apply to the pillars that uphold the empire. So they need a lot of data, and we've seen a number of artists and writers, for example, sue the companies over the seizure of their data, their intellectual property by these companies. That is using litigation as a form of pressure to try and move the needle on the data front. When it comes to data centers, we've seen at this point dozens, maybe hundreds of protests that are breaking out around the world that are really trying to block data center projects that are not being installed in the interests of the communities. This has effectively blocked tens of billions of dollars of data center projects at this point across different parts of the US, Latin America, and Europe. And so that's like yet another point at which individuals and organized efforts are applying pressure to a key ingredient in how these empires operate. Also, public pressure works well. We have seen an outcry from parents in recent months, especially as there have been more and more cases of models like ChatGPT leading to the deaths of children, where parents are so outraged that companies are feeling way more pressure to respond. There was actually just an announcement that OpenAI made a couple days ago, where they said that they are actually going to join forces with one of the leading kids' safety institutes in the US to propose a joint ballot initiative for putting more legislation into force in California for protecting kids from the harms of their own technologies. And I really think that this was the result of many, 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 many parents just be asserting how furious they were with the fact that these technologies are repeating the same mistakes as social media companies. In terms of as consumers voting with our feet from one tool to another, one of the challenges right now is there's not a lot of consumer alternatives that are very easy to use out of the box. And so that's something that I think we need to see more development of. And this is where European companies can step in and be the alternatives. For ChatGPT and for Claude, I would not consider Anthropic to be any better than OpenAI, in that they are also engaging in this very harmful scaling approach and trying to chase the creation of an AI god. And I hope also that, with the fashion industry, for example, we saw a lot of organizations basically create a market for sustainable and ethical fashion. As more and more investigations started revealing that there were some horrific things that were happening within the fashion industry supply chain, we had, different organizations that were ranking different types of fashion brands on their values and their ability to uphold labor rights and environmental rights. And we need to see the same thing with AI as well. So that's another area that we don't see a lot of currently, but if we can have more organization move into that space, that will help facilitate consumers to make better choices.
Yeah. And speaking about better choices, now the tough question is the question we get a lot, why we are still using Zoom. Actually, I can answer that question very easily. So we are looking for something different that can have 3,000 people with up to 10 languages interpreted live from Europe. If you have that tool and know about it, please let us know. It's really about, as Karen said, it's sometimes about the alternative. So, it's always a big question. All the big questions in Europe calling, asking that ourselves. So no worries. Whoever asked that question, we are constantly thinking about this. So I wanna use the last 11 minutes to get a couple of oral questions in here because it's always so unpredictable. I love it. So we don't know what's coming. It's usually nice. It's always actually nice. But let's see who gets a question. So I will actually start with Nadine Milde, who I've spoken to with actually before this webinar, and I know roughly in which direction Nadine is going. So Nadine, and I'm calling on you now, but please be very quick. Like for all of you that are now doing oral questions, please be very quick and very specific so we can quickly do a lot of questions. So Nadine, there we go. Unmuting yourself, and here you are.
Oh no, we brought two questions. First
Uh-oh.
of all, thanks so much for all of your great inputs and your fantastic book, Karen Howe. I should say that I'm not here alone, but together with a new working group, Digital Global, which is an intersectional group of the green think tanks on global development, digital, and EU policies. So if anyone would like to get in touch, Max has our contact. Now, the questions. Karen Howe, you have sketched an ideal role that the EU could play, but in reality, right now, the EU plays a somewhat ambiguous role in the face of the US American empire of AI and big tech. For one, because it remains to be seen whether it will submit to US pressure or assert its values and regulatory power. And also because it remains to be seen whether EU values will mean European-based corporate business interests or an actual strengthening of democratic open source common good technologies, possibly as a joint effort together with non-European countries. So, what would you say is the current role of Europe in or against AI tech imperialism? Is the EU a colonized, a colonizer, or possibly both? And we have a much quicker second question.
Okay, very quick, Nadine.
Yes, you have highlighted the many parallels between the empire of AI and historical colonial empires. What, for the better or worse, are some of the key paradigmatic differences and specificities of the digital empire, besides the lack of open violence and brutality mentioned in your book? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nadine. Given that to Karen, will be difficult. We'll also open the floor to the other two, so you don't have to answer all of it. I think Alexander can go in some as well, but please, Karen.
Yeah, I guess very quickly, to me, part of the reason why Europe is in this ambiguous moment at the right now is because there is this narrative being asserted that I think asserts a false dichotomy between progress and safety. And what I tried to articulate in my talk was this idea that actually you can make a significant and substantial, real human rights-based democratic progress. Develop AI systems that are broadly useful to people and also not have to engage in this race to the bottom. And so I don't have a ton of visibility into what Brussels is saying. That would be for Alexandra to answer, but I do hope that Europe actually realizes this and doubles down on creating types of AI systems that actually advance like a totally different vision for AI. And in terms of what is the difference for empires of AI at the moment, it's the speed. I mean, older empires, they advance themselves at the speed of ships, you know? And that's not what we're seeing now. OpenAI can make decisions, 50 decisions in an hour, and update their models and suddenly affect hundreds of millions of people and soon billions of people around the world. And so we are in a bit of a crisis in terms of regulatory systems. Legislative systems were designed for a different speed in terms of governance. And of course, there's Mariëtte Schaak, an MEP, former MEP from the Netherlands, has also talked about how there needs to be innovation, not just in the technological sense, but in the legislative sense, where we design new, more responsive mechanisms for governance.
Thank you. Maybe getting Alexandra in on it in terms of.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick because we have a few minutes left. I think right now we are colonized, to be very honest, but it's a question of political will to, and also will of the industry and of businesses to turn that around. I think that is so important because right now we are not really playing out our strength. Not politically, we're not enforcing our regulation, we're not heavily investing in technologies, in new digital technologies. But I think we do have all the resources that you need. We have a great education system in Europe. We have excellent research. We still have an excellent industrial base that in some areas the US don't have anymore, for example. We have a lot of production still in Europe. And that's a lot of interesting data, for example, for AI applications. And we have very strong democratic institution, and I hear an increasing number of US companies who are very worried about the loss of rule of law in the US, because in the end that becomes a problem for corporations as well. So having these strong democratic institutions and rule of law in Europe still, at least for the moment, I think that's also a very strong competitive advantage. But what we really need to muster is a very strong political will as across all parties and across all levels. And I'm working on it. I think it's advancing. In the last year, there have been really, really big steps in the right direction, but it's definitely, definitely not done yet. And this is where we need people as well. You know, it's not only about what kind of choices do you make in your daily life, but it's what kind of political voice do you use? What kind of contribution do you make to political debates and asking for technological sovereignty in Europe and prioritizing this area? I think that's also something very important that everybody can do.
Thank you. Maybe getting Michael in here as well. So, Karen said about, more dynamic regulation and, when you interact with the European level, or I saw like on one of your slides, there are also quite a lot of questions about, how you're funded in terms of patent status and all of this. So maybe going to send you the questions after, so if there's some interested in there. But I'm interested in when you're trying to apply for funding. For example, I think you got some from the federal level in Germany, right? So, but what is the situation with European funding for those kind of pilot assemblies like you did, for example?
At a pilot line we basically built from our equity that we raised with our first investor. So there was not much federal funding involved. However, to build the chips, at least the German government was very supportive here to push this technology. But I wanted to make another comment. Please give me the chance.
Sure.
Please, please, please don't forget the following aspect. OpenAI burned 8.5 billion last year. So while they are the first, please don't think that they already won the race. To me, success feels profitable success. It feels like that a company has made it to continue its own future or define its own future from its own earned money. So currently, even these gigantic seeming OpenAI companies, as Microsoft, as all the others, have still not found the profitable key to successful business with AI. And this is still the point that Europe can make. So there is a lot of opportunity, there is a lot of technology that's needed in order to turn this vision into something that's a sustainable industry. So the question is whether we are conquered or what we can still conquer. I would say that we should become tradable. They have aspects that we need to the future, but we should have goods, chips, software, ecosystems that we can basically offer them as tradable replacements for what they have built in the past. This should be our mission. This is something very important to me because it seems like that there is this gigantic US and they already have everything and we should go home and whatever. No, they have not won. They've been first, but they're still bleeding money. And this is our chance to get something on par eye level in that game that gives us a tradable future because it won't be the US or Europe. It has to be jointly. That's clear. But currently, we are often shocked by how the US communicative wise also dominates this game. And this is something we should just ignore, keep on our mission and build something.
Great. Thank you. I would still want to, well, we have not much time left, but I will just give the floor to Birgit Huberts, who kind of was raising her hand from the very beginning. So Birgit, if you when du sprechen magst, if you want to ask a question, a quick one, you're gonna have the last word. Du hast das letzte Wort. Auf Deutsch oder Englisch ist egal. Birgit. Ah, jetzt klappt's nicht. Dann nehme ich noch Agnes dran. One Citizens, I wanna do. Agnes, du könntest dein Mikro jetzt freischalten und eine Frage stellen. So, nein, das dauert dann jetzt zu lange, dafür haben wir keine Zeit. Dann will ich noch eine letzte Abschlussfrage machen. Und zwar, wenn man sich mit dem Thema beschäftigt, kommt man sehr, sehr nah dran an das Thema Bubble. Also sind wir jetzt gerade, oh, sorry, I need to switch language again, sorry. So when we talk about the topic and you all mentioned it in a way that we are, you know, all the companies investing in each other and so much money in the system. And I think it's now, I heard a number that 2/3 of the growth of the US last year was actually on data centers, like 2/3. I mean, it's ridiculous, actually. And so is that, you know, what is your feeling? We didn't do a quick round and then we close. It's like, are we just a month away from like a bubble bursting, like the dot-com bubble burst back 25 years ago with serious consequences for like the world economy essentially. So what do you think? Are we in the middle of a bubble about to burst, or is it gonna carry on a long time? So, and I'm gonna do Michael, Alexandra, and then Karen.
Thanks a lot. Yes, we are in a bubble and there will be a correction. Don't ask me when it's going to happen because in that case I would be a prophet. But it's not like the dot-com because there is way more substance in this AI and there are too many industries involved, and this is the big differentiator to the dot-com crisis that we've seen where companies were built with nothing. That's not the case here. But yes, I expect that there will be a financial correction on the stock market because the values of the companies are not matching to their actual profitable business case.
Thank you, Alexandra.
Well, like Michael said, nobody knows when this is going to happen. Everybody knows there's a big bubble. Nobody knows when it's going to burst and if it's going to burst, because this is also about political power. So what can the Trump administration depends a lot on this bubble staying a bubble and not bursting. And they have been investing a lot in companies, you know, and Europeans always think, well, US, that's all private economy and the government is not doing anything. And this is absolutely not true. They're heavily investing in companies that work on minerals and rare earth. They invested heavily in Intel. They're buying up company shares all over the place. So what are they going to do to bolster this kind of bubble and keep it from bursting? I think that is a more political question. And this is why nobody can answer the question, when is it going to burst? Because we don't know to what length the government is going to go in the US to keep that bubble, how do you say that? You know, keep it existing. So we don't know, but I think the more interesting thing would be also to get European economists to point that out, to calculate it, because I'm a little bit sick of hearing, you know, GDP per capita in the US is so much higher than in Germany, when that doesn't consider the contribution of the AI bubble. So if you correct it, probably the American economy looks very differently. And also it doesn't consider the cost of living, because that's a thing that really this puts pressure on us in Brussels and also in Germany. I hear a lot of German businessmen and entrepreneurs saying, yeah, but the US, you know, people are so much richer. And this is absolutely not true. You know, the quality of life is so much worse in the US. Purchasing power is so much worse. People spend half of their salary on healthcare. And realizing that our economy is not doing as badly as many people think, that we do need to invest in innovation and we do need to do things, but we also need to believe in ourselves. And that is very important. And this is why it's so important to speak about the bubble. But when it's going to burst, nobody knows.
Thank you. Karen, the last word.
Maybe Karen knows.
No, I don't. I 100% agree with everything both of you said. And I would just add that, yeah, as an American, I can absolutely tell you that the US is not doing well. You know, it's not a wealthy country when you remove the billionaires. And that is part of the reason why Mamdani won in New York, for example. He campaigned on the idea of an affordability crisis. And now the entire Democratic Party in the US has realized that this is the key formula to winning elections, because everyone is feeling the vulnerability of not being able to afford living, surviving in the US anymore. I think the last thing I would just add is this, whether I think we sometimes fixate a little bit too much on like when the bubble is going to burst. For me, the question is, what should we be doing because we know it will likely burst in the future? And for Europe, I think that just means continuing to double down on making sure that the EU is investing in technologies in the ecosystem for its native indigenous AI development, such that when the bubble bursts, Europe is ready to step in to that vacuum.
Thank you so much. That was a very great final word. I'm just going to say thank you to all of you. Thank you to the over, I mean, we're very close to 3,000 people simultaneously in this webinar. This is really amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for our interpreters, to our interpreters. And yeah, so have you all a good evening. I want to just plug in the next Europe Calling webinar here, which is on Monday, not yet announced, but I'm announcing it now. We're going to do an urgent webinar on the situation in the United States, actually, after the murder of René Good in Minneapolis. We're going to do an urgent one with two voices from the US, trying to understand what it means for civil society there, and also what it means for civil society here to learn from that, what is happening right now in the US. So there's going to be an urgent webinar on that on Monday, and then we're going to talk more later in the month. You will get all the emails, and see you at our next Europe Calling, and have a nice evening. Bye bye.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.